Do you love freedom? Do you love being clean? Then you'll love Hero Soap Company, made in the USA. Chemical and fragrance free. A portion of each purchase donated to veteran and first responder charities. Initial subscription purchase is matched bar for bar and sent overseas to deploy troops. Let freedom clean. Hero Soap Company.
Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Today my guest is John Klyzak. Before I bring him on, a couple of announcements. Upcoming, we have Forbidden Knowledge News Con 2022. It's going to be March 11th, 12th, and 13th with 8 amazing presenters. It's going to be online with a Rockfin premium account. That means you can get the entire conference for only $10. All you have to do is sign up through that link in the description with Rockfin, and you get access to not only the conference, but all our premium content and all the content from every creator on Rockfin. You can always also get new episodes free on Rockfin, Odyssey, and all podcast platforms. And definitely check out the podcasts that we feature on the Forbidden Knowledge Network. You get those on our website, forbiddenknowledge.news. And be sure to follow us on Facebook, both our Facebook pages. Those links are all in the description. Today I want to welcome back to the show John Klyzak. He has an MA in English and has taught college rhetoric and research argumentation for over 8 years. His literary scholarship concentrates on the history of global eugenics and Aldous Huxley's dystopic novel, Brave New World. He is the author of School World Order, The Technocratic Globalization of Corporatized Education, and he is a contributor to the Center for Research on Globalization, Op-Ed News, The Intrepid Report, The Dissident Voice, Counter Markets, David Icke News, Natural News, and many other independent news sources. He is also the director of writing and editing at Black Freighter Productions Books. John, welcome back, and how you doing?
Yeah, it's okay. You know, it's could have used a little longer break, but it's all good.
Yeah, man, it's great to have you back on. Last time we spoke, the whole COVID narrative was really kind of just getting started, and the information we discussed is starting to magically manifest into reality somehow. And the direction the education system is headed is, it seems it's going to be a whole new slave indoctrination system with streamlined propaganda straight from the phone, computer, TV, right to your child's brain. So we've got that to look forward to. But since it's been a while since we spoke, I'd love it if you could remind the audience, what was it that really ultimately led you down the path you're on?
Well, so as far as the book is concerned, I'm a teacher. I teach at a couple community colleges. I'm an adjunct. And man, it's a long time now. I want to say almost at least 5, maybe 7 years ago, the governor in Illinois, Bruce Rauner, he was stalling on passing the budget. And I saw this as a move to privatize the education system, or to privatize public education in particular. So that means something called school choice. So through public-private partnerships known as charter schools. And, I never really planned to write about education at the time because, you know, I didn't want to poo-poo where I worked. But, some of my departments where I was teaching got shut down. And so my employment started to be in jeopardy. So I, you know, sort of decided, well, maybe I should at least, you know, vocalize what I think is going on here. And so I wrote an article about what was going on with the school choice and the privatization in Illinois. And my dear friend, Charlotte Thompson Iserby, who wrote The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America, she got wind of that article and reached out to me and was like, you know, you're right on. And then that article just sort of built into a series of articles that moves basically from looking at the privatization of education to changing academics to workforce training, the elimination of locally elected school boards. And then the second element of the book really focuses on technology and the way that technology would be facilitated and to facilitate the privatization. And so when we look at the technology, I pretty much broke it down into three categories of technology. And so that's the Skinner box machine, which is basically an operant conditioning computer that's going to data mine students' cognitive behavioral algorithms. Then another set of technologies that fall under something called socio-emotional learning. So that's going to, those largely involve wearables like the galvanic skin response monitors and companies like BrainCo and NeuroCore that measure EEGs. And so those are going to data mine the students' emotional algorithms. And then a third set of technologies that fall under a category called precision education, which is basically data mining students' DNA. And so put all three of those data sets together, and then there's going to be this technocratic implementation of personalized education. And then from there, that data will be used to develop artificial intelligence, so both weak AI and what they call strong AI or artificial general intelligence, and then merging the human body with that AI through brain-computer interfaces hooked up to the Internet of Things and the Internet of Bodies. And so that's pretty much the full spectrum of everything and sort of how I got started on it.
Man, it sounds like a fucking science fiction movie whenever you look at it like that. So it's very crazy. Did you think that we would be moving this fast, like, say, you know, a couple of years ago when we spoke, that they would be implementing everything? It seems like they're moving so fast. They're making a lot of mistakes. A lot of people are waking up to this BS. I don't know what else they could throw at us. Do you see the same thing, kind of like this really too fast moving agenda?
Yeah, I mean, I hope it's too fast, right? Because then that plays out in our favor, but definitely super fast, right? And so I thought when I wrote the book, that would have at least 10 years, if not more. You know, the date that the transhumanists always point to for the singularity is somewhere between 2030 and 2045, right? So I figured I had getting roughly close to about 2030 to sort of warn people and, you know, sound less and less crazy as this stuff got sort of rolled out piecemeal. But, you know, with COVID now, everything is just, you know, the pedal to the metal. And, you know, funny enough, though, when I was on the Ed Opperman show, I want to say it was January of 2020, he basically asked me, you know, what's the time frame we're looking at when all this stuff gets put together in a like a social credit system? And I said, well, I gave him the singularity date, but I said, well, but, you know, the right crisis could accelerate things. And then it wasn't 2 months later that we had COVID. And so, you know, I guess I got the book out just in time. It came out in October of 2019. And next thing you know, everything is just moving full speed ahead.
Yeah, it's pretty insane. And, you know, now they're trying to implement and bring forward this metaverse, which adds a whole new layer to all the agendas that they're pushing forth, and a lot of realization for people who have been looking at this a long time, like, huh, they want everybody to stay home and just plug in and never fucking leave, right?
Yeah, so that was another element of it with the VR and the AR. And, you know, they sort of posited it like there would be a what's also called mixed reality. So using like Google Glass or Oculus or a combination of both, right? So the Oculus is going to put you in a fully immersive digital reality. And then you have your AR, which is you're going to wear these goggles, and it's sort of going to provide a digital layer over the real world through other sensors that would connect to like the Internet of Things, right? And so they sort of posited it like, you know, the two technologies would sort of help develop this sort of AR realm where, you know, let's say you go to a party and you got your Google Glass on and you can scan everybody, you can face scan everybody and you can get their Facebook profiles and you could know before you have to have any awkward social interactions, like, hey, this person likes the music I like, or this person likes the politics I like. But when I look at the metaverse and the way that everything, you know, in the midst of this lockdown, I mean, it almost looks like they want to move towards something more Matrix-like, as you mentioned, you know, with very limited human contact, with very limited need for an AR in the real world, as if we're going to spend most of our time in virtual reality. And that's what Ray Kurzweil says in The Singularity Is Near, that, you know, increasingly you will spend ultimately most of your time in virtual reality. So basically, the metaverse, and then you have to wonder, well, then, so, you know, how will humans be productive in an economic sense, right? A lot of this is managed by, you know, multinational corporations sort of planning the global economy. And it just seems that, you know, through the VR, eventually you'll have all these wearables on you. And I think they've already got some smart gloves that are supposed to mimic, like, this. So when you grab an object in the metaverse, is supposed to give the sense of you're actually touching something with like little air bubbles in there and some sort of feeling of resistance. So, you know, with smart shirts and wearables and smart gloves, they can sort of just data mine the whole biopsychosocial process. And you'll basically be a little battery in the metaverse where they just keep pulling data to further improve their AI systems.
It makes me wonder with the experimental jabs that they're giving out to everybody, if this is, you know, another layer to this, if this could possibly be altering human DNA to better fit into this digital reality that we're going to be living in, because we don't know what's in these fucking things. It's some DNA altering technology. We know that DARPA has been involved. So who knows what the real underlying reasons or other agendas could be behind these injections, you know?
Well, definitely it kicks the door open for something called precision medicine, which is related to what I just mentioned earlier, which is precision education. So precision medicine, that term predates precision education. Precision education is a play on precision medicine. And precision medicine is all about gene therapies. It's all about personalizing your healthcare based on your genetic signature, okay? And so, you know, in the realm of precision education, you would get what's posited by a guy named Robert Plomin as a learning chip that would sort of have all of your DNA sequences in there. And those would correlate with particular propensities for either gifted academics, or maybe, you know, you have some sort of a learning disability, and that's going to track you into what they call a career pathway prior to any data mining. Prior to data mining your thinking algorithms or your feeling algorithms, they're going to say, hey, wait a minute, you got this DNA sequence here that says, you know, you're not so sharp. So we're not going to waste our time and money on trying to put you in the academic route. We're just going to put you straight in the workforce training route. But, you know, if you're wealthy enough, right, maybe you can get a gene therapy that can improve that DNA, right? We can give you sort of a CRISPR edit or some other gene modification where, okay, now your DNA is up to par. Now we can data mine your thinking algorithms to put you on the trajectory for something more academic, or for something other than pushing buttons and pulling levers.
I want to go back to a little bit about our educational system's history, because a lot of people don't realize that a lot of the control goes back to Skull and Bones. And that's all, you know, a lot of our educational history is surrounded by some of these institutions, right?
Yeah, 100%. So Skull and Bones is super important in the rollout of compulsory education through people like Alfonso Taft, who founded the Order of Skull and Bones. And then also some of the Ivy League type or elite colleges were set up by Skull and Bones members. So in many ways, the university system itself, not Yale and Harvard, but as we, you know, westward expansion, you know, schools like Johns Hopkins University and University of California, Berkeley were set up by Daniel Coit Gilman, Andrew Dixon White, and Timothy Dwight were all involved in setting up these various colleges. And then you also have the hand of Skull and Bones in setting up the psychological conditioning methods and pedagogies that are used to develop the modern day teaching machines, which are the adaptive learning softwares. And those are those technologies that data mine the cognitive behavioral thinking algorithms. And those particular Bonesmen would include Daniel Quaid Gilman, who appointed G. Stanley Hall to be the first professor or first chair of psychology. So he chaired the first psychology department in the United States of America. He was also the head of the APA, American Psychological Association. But the reason why Gilman picked him was because he was a student of Wilhelm Wundt. And Wilhelm Wundt was actually the founding father of laboratory psychology out in Leipzig, Germany. And so he hired Hall, and Hall would teach Dewey, and Dewey would later teach John B. Watson, another famous behaviorist, okay? And then if you pass that torch down through from Hall to Watson, and then people like E.L. Thorndike, eventually you get to B.F. Skinner, and B.F. Skinner is the guy who prototyped the early teaching machines. And so those we have now digital algorithms, but his were basically on analog machines with, you know, gears and wheels and things like that. But his research for the development of these technologies was funded by McGeorge Bundy, which is another member of the Order of Skull and Bones, when he was the dean at Harvard Graduate School. And my research after I wrote the book, I stumbled on you know, tying in the teaching machine algorithms, moving it into the realm of brain-computer interfaces, where we're basically going to put the stimulus response algorithm neurologically straight in your body instead of an external stimulus on a screen. Well, Jose Manuel Rodriguez Delgado, he's the guy who basically prototyped the early brain chips, so to speak. So he had neural implants that were very crude in the sense that you could target like the limbic system, so you could mess with people's their aggression or their libido and things like that. And he wanted to use them for quelling, quote, inner city riots. And so that's the groundwork for, you know, your Elon Musk Neuralink, and Facebook has its own thought to type brain computer interfaces. But there's several members of the Order of Skull and Bones that surround him. And my memory is a little cloudy. If I can share my screen, I can pull up my database. Let me see here. So if I share that, I'm in the wrong. Oh, here we go. Here's Archibald McLeish. That should get us to the Order of Skull and Bones. And by the way, this is, if anybody wants to see this, I've been running this. I update it weekly. It's on a paywall. It's a subscription thing, $5 a month, but you'll see here I've got the catalog here. I've got the Order of Skull and Bones catalog book. Charlotte gave me the physical copy to scan and upload. But if I take a look at brain computer interfaces here, and I look at, we should have Manuel Rodriguez Delgado. And so the three Bonesmen here are Charles Stafford Gage, Frank Davis Ashburn, and then Hannibal Hamlin was his assistant when they were basically putting these electrodes in mental patients. And he, it's his son or his grandson, Charles B. Hamlin, who is currently a member of the Order of Skull and Bone. So Hamlin himself, Hannibal, was not a member of the Order, but he did help Delgado build those. And Charles Stafford Gage was the head of the Yale Treasury at the time. And so, you know, the funding for that would have basically been funneled through him. And if my memory serves me correct, Frank Davis Ashburn, he helped set up the science department, or at least restructured it right around the time that Delgado gets set up there. So you've got the funding and the departmental structure sort of tied to these Bonesmen who are floating around him. And then if you know, go a couple of generations down, you've got his partner, who is also a member of the Order.
Man, it's insane how these people knew the direction that our technology would be going. I mean, we already know that probably technology that they're not telling us is either 50, maybe 100, maybe more years ahead of what's in the public sector. And they knew back then they had advanced probably way ahead of what they were showing the public back then. And they knew the direction that we'd be headed. And all these documents that we can look at from that time period, it's amazing to see how it all turned out in the direction that we're going.
Yeah, actually, let me actually share that again, because Charlotte, when I went and visited Charlotte for 30 days in October of last year, she needed some help around the house and stuff, and she gave me access to all of her files. So while I was cleaning out the barn and doing stuff like that, she had 36 file cabinets that she let me dig through, and she actually just let me take basically everything out of it. And so some of the files that I found, you know, she's collecting these files for, she was, in the State Department, in the 50s, right? But she's collecting these educational documents, so at least for 40 years, ever since she was in the department in the 80s, okay? And if I were to go to and take a look at, let's go to UNESCO here, which if I go to my global governance institutions, my UN, and then my UNESCO, there was something I found in her file called Study 11. Here it is, UNESCO Study 11. And this was set up in the early 80s. The files were leaked to her by this guy here, Lawrence P. Grayson, who is the UNESCO liaison with the Department of Education under Donald Sinise. So this is while she was there. Now, Grayson gave her these files after she blew the whistle and was let go for leaking the Project BEST document. But what I found was that if you take a look at this, Study 11 really was to say Project BEST was America's domestic version of UNESCO Study 11. UNESCO Study 11 actually partnered with both Western capitalist countries, but also Eastern Bloc communist and socialist countries. Okay, but they were all using the multinational companies to sort of distribute or to set up an international infrastructure for these internet or information communication technologies. And if you look at in the set of files there. There was something called, there it is, the Cyclops Project. And the Cyclops Project is affiliated with the UK's Open University, which now has a distance learning college. And so back then, before they had distance learning like on Zoom, it was basically correspondence. So like, you would send an application and you'd get assigned a course and they would send you either reading materials or, throughout the 70s, 80s, they would have audiovisual, so cassette tapes and things like that. And then you would, have a lesson on that and then you do the assignment and mail it back. And then you do this, sending back and forth. And that was how you would get your degree. So that later branches out into this thing called FutureLearn, which is one of the largest online education or distance learning platforms in Europe. But associated with this was this thing called the Cyclops Project. And what it is, when I show it to you, you'll see that it's an early version of basically Microsoft Teams or Google Classroom or what you might call, let me grab my keyboard here, sorry about that.
Well, these are all out in the public sector, right?
No, a lot of these are not. That's what makes them special as well, because like this is, maybe you could find it on a journal database somewhere, but it's certainly you're not going to find it on a Google search. And it was hard for me to find anything on Study 11 at all with a Google search. You can find some stuff, but I have pretty much all the documents for each country, that was involved in the project in terms of what they did and what they found, what type of software they were using, what companies they were using. How it was tied to their ministries or departments of education. So a lot of this stuff is actually not, or it's just so old that it's, they've either just thrown it out of the library or otherwise not uploaded it to any databases. So if I scroll down on this document, you'll see here that they have a model. Here it is. And so you'll see here, basically what you have is a really crude version of sort of like, instead of, and this is what they were talking about in the UNESCO Study 11, was that they needed to get the microprocessor small enough where you can actually have this in every person's classroom, but also in the hands of every student and in the home, okay? And so you'll see here, basically, they have, I think there's a better picture of it, actually. Yeah, here it is. This is a little bit better here. Oops. Yeah, this
one is 1982.
Yeah, this is 1982. Okay, so here, this is a better set. So you've got like a television here. So that's where you're gonna see, you know, the lesson that's being beamed to you. Okay. Then you've also got over here, let me pull it back, make it a little bit bigger. So this is basically like where you're gonna speak into it. So it's basically got like a radio hooked up to a TV, hooked up to a keyboard, hooked up to this light pen so that you could, like, you know, I don't know, either push the multiple choice or the matching, or maybe even scribe something onto the digital screen. And then it's hooked up down here to these modems, and then you've got a recorder here so that you can keep the lessons. But you see, it's a big clunky thing, right? I mean, it's like, it's literally just taking all of the different audiovisual technologies and combining them into like a proto dial-up internet system, okay? And this was going to be the model for Zoom type, you know, the Microsoft Teams, Google Classroom technologies. This is, so now, obviously, I mean, you know, you could do this on your phone, right? And I actually have students who don't have computers, right, who will, you know, log in through their phone. So pretty much, they had this whole paradigm, you know, it was an objective in the early 80s. They just needed to get the technology to be efficient enough where they could have it in every classroom and have it in your home. But basically, you know, this is sort of early prototypes for the fourth industrial revolution.
Right, man, that is so interesting. I thought maybe we could go over some of the most important aspects that people should know about Project BEST, the Better Education Skills Through Technology, and what, you know, we could be looking at as something that could be coming into fruition or already has.
So basically, it was, and I've got the entire document in there, and that's that for sure. You're not going to find that full document anywhere else except for on that database. And it's, you know, it's thick like this, and it's basically everything that Charlotte talked about in her deliberate dumbing down of America. So it involves public-private partnerships between schools and technology corporations. It involves basically removing academics with workforce training. And it involves using what is effectively the Skinner box teaching machine, okay? And so the cognitive behavioral conditioning algorithms. But if you look at how it's tied into UNESCO, somebody like Bill Spady, who was the Far West Regional Education Laboratory. He was one of the regional education laboratories. And one of the ways that he also used to promote it was that you'd be able to, like, have a global classroom, so you'd be able to communicate with other students across the globe. And another aspect of it, though, is that it would, when you read the Project BEST document, it basically says that this model can also be used for all other sectors of civil society and the economy, meaning healthcare, criminal justice, we already said workforce, mental health, okay? And so if we think about the way that we're sort of moving into this COVID era, you know, in order to even go to school, you have to basically provide your health status, which is, you know, it's basically a social credit thing, right? And then you'll also see in there the algorithms, like, so when we look at the social emotional learning, right? Something that the schools are doing now is there's all these wellness programs because, you know, understandably, students are, and I'm sure faculty as well, You know, being locked in your house all day is not good for your mental health, right? So they've got like these Google wellness forums and these other check-ins where it's like, hey, how are you feeling today? Well, you know, based on how you respond to that, maybe, you know, they might put you on a, you know, a therapy program, or maybe they might prescribe you some pharmaceuticals, or, right, if we want to go to the realm of like pre-crime, we could maybe say something like, this student is looking like they're exhibiting some agitated behaviors that could make them somehow delinquent, or, you know, have a propensity to do something criminal in the relatively near future. And then so they can have also mental health interventions on the under the purpose of preventing crime as well. And so this is sort of where the education technology isn't just, again, it's not just looking at how is the student learning and, you know, how can we personalize it? It's looking at the full spectrum of the student's biopsychosocial life. So we're also looking at, you know, and all of it sort of influencing the other. So your health data is going to influence your learning data, is going to influence, is going to influence your criminal justice data.
And it sounds like what they're already doing in China, you know, monitoring their workers, you know, biological readings and health, and, you know, seeing if they need food, and then they have the social credit system on top of that. You know, do you think that there is some sort of involvement by China with these types of agendas?
Oh, for sure. So, I mean, at one level, I can tell you that BrainCo, this BrainCo helmet, it's a headband, okay? It's like it looks like a little halo, basically. It's called the Focus One headband, and they use it in Chinese classrooms, and it's hooked up to their AI system. So essentially, it's hooked up to their social credit system. If you want to see what that looks like and be really freaked out, there's a Wall Street Journal piece in which they did a short little documentary. So if you just type in the search engine, China Wall Street Journal BrainCo, that should pull up the video. Okay. And when you watch this, you'll see that all the students they're sitting around and they've got these halos on that measure their EEGs. And those EEGs are supposed to tell the teacher, like, you know, are they paying attention? Are they enjoying the curriculum? Are they daydreaming? Are they like upset by the curriculum? Is there some sort of a resistance to accepting whatever they're trying to indoctrinate them with? And then all that data goes to this dashboard that the teacher has, but they also send that data back home to mom and dad, right? So just to reinforce, you know, the indoctrination, okay? You know, mom might say, hey, your social credit score is going down because you're daydreaming too much. Right. Your teacher's trying to get you to pay attention, but you're not, you know, you're not obeying. So, you know, mom and dad sort of come in and reinforce that. But that product itself was developed with the help of a team from Harvard University. OK. And at the same time, you also have American corporations funding effectively the social credit system, because the social credit system, okay, it basically is managed by what's called Ant Financial, which is a fintech or a financial tech company. Okay, and then that is linked to the Alipay system, which is part of the Alibaba Corporation. And Alibaba is funded by none other than BlackRock, which is, you know, basically owns half of everything in this country and probably across the planet. And then you also have companies like Salesforce, which is another big tech company that also funds the Alibaba Corporation. So we have all sorts of big tech companies in the United States that have been financing and effectively building the social credit system. And so pretty much, you know, what I saw from the beginning of the pandemic, and I've said it for almost, I guess, getting close to 2 years now, in the early weeks, I knew that they had the social credit system in China. And so, you know, we were basically a couple weeks behind Italy and China in terms of locking down and the policies that we were rolling out. So I said, so I was always looking over here to kind of see what were they going to try next over here. And early on, way before they had any kind of vaccines, They had basically immunity passports, or rather contact tracing passports. So in China, you had to download these apps onto your phone, and then you got a QR code. It was either red, yellow, or green. Now, if it was red, you had to quarantine for the full length. If it's yellow, it was a shorter period. If it's green, you're good to go to work or wherever you need to go. And so, you know, I said right away, I said, you know, before this is over, they're going to try two things. And one is mandatory vaccines, and the other one's going to be this contact tracing or immunity passport system, which will be your digital ID, which can be on that blockchain platform. You can just expand it out to include all the other data we talked about, all the different sets of education data, but also your workforce records, also your criminal justice records, also your mental health records, right? And so effectively, the pandemic has provided an impetus for these big tech companies in the United States to basically bring back over the social credit system that they've been funding and building in China for some time now.
Now, the federal rules on distance learning and innovation documents, when did those come out?
So I want to say that those, we'll just call them deregulations. I want to say April of 2020, around that time. I might be off by a month or so. Okay. And effectively what those did was deregulated the requirements for what constituted teaching. Okay. And so basically there's a clause in there that says it used to largely involve some form of teacher to student interaction. And they're saying now that no, adapt, and they say, quote, adaptive learning, which is the modern teaching machine. It's the cognitive behavioral software and other forms of, and they say, quote, artificial intelligence that can constitute instruction while we're on these digital platforms. And there's a bunch of other, you know, education jargon buzzwords in there that relate to that, like competency-based education, direct instruction, mastery learning, et cetera.
Now, I've heard this competency-based education. I mean, what is this supposed to mean?
So it's an extension of what's known as outcomes-based education. So outcomes-based education, basically, the goal of teaching under this methodology is that you want the student to end up at a particular place in terms of what they know and what they can do, right? It's not about just providing concepts and knowledge, and then the student can put that together and take it where he or she wants to go, right, and be creative with it. I mean, obviously, you want in terms of knowledge, you do want the concept to be understood, but right, how the student applies it is something else. And so the competency-based element, and it, by the way, it relates to something called PPBS, so that's Planning, Programming, and Budgeting Systems, and that comes out of the military, okay? And so the outcome for the student in terms of what he or she knows and what he or she does is going to align with outcomes in the business world and in the political world, and then also in the geopolitical world in terms of, like, you know, foreign policy. So this overarching global structure, how is the student going to fit into the global economy and various national policies or international policies? So the competency-based education is basically where it's an iteration of outcomes-based, but it's just that the outcomes you need are basically going to be individualized, again, personalized, and it's sort of what Charlotte would have called the dumbing down, okay? So we only need you to be competent enough in those outcomes, okay? We don't need you to have, I was going to say mastery, but that's another jargon word that actually relates to both OBE and CBE. But you don't need the student to have comprehensive understanding of a particular lesson. You just need the student to be able to pull the lever or push the button so that they can meet the larger outcomes of whatever is in the planned economy.
All right. Now, could you talk about the significance of the CARES Act grants and what that means for the education system?
Yeah. So I actually, so funny story was at one of the community colleges where I teach, there were some people upset that so we got the CARES money, and then they had a CARES panel or committee of various faculty members that were going to oversee how we spent the money. And this, the money was allocated largely for PPE, so you know, your protective equipment, you know, to prevent transmission and stuff like that. But the rest of it was basically for technology to facilitate the distance learning. And people at the college were upset that there was basically no tool. There was none at the time. There was no teachers basically on the panel, right? It was like all administrators, and somebody kind of sent an email. They were a little upset, and I kind of chimed in very politely to agree that, yeah, you know, I think there should be some teachers in here. And I sent them what you just referenced, which was FR. Oh, it's been so long. I used to have that number memorized, Pat, but the federal distance regulations. I know there was an 8 and a 6 in it. Thank you. And so when I sent them that, they were like, oh, you look knowledgeable as far as, you know, how the moving parts in terms of funding and regulations and things. Why don't you be the adjunct representative? So I went in there, and basically what they, by sending out this CARES money, they were basically giving you money. First of all, you had to lock down to get the money and to receive, right? You had to be in compliance with lockdowns, which means you had to be in compliance with the PPE part, which, you know, some schools, I was lucky that at least one of my schools isn't as hardcore as the other, you know, with, in terms of like contact tracing and, you know, the various applications, right, and technologies that they were using to sort of track that. Basically being wedged into this place where you have to lock down, well, now you have to buy these technologies that we otherwise wouldn't have used. And, you know, I gotta tell you that the whole process of that was very disconcerting, because most people kind of, when they sent their proposals for, like, you know, simulators or other platforms or apps that were going to facilitate some kind of a lesson in one department or another, I mean, they were, the proposals themselves were very bare bones, and the reaction of everybody was sort of rubber stamp. I mean, my reaction was always like, okay, you need a simulator, but what kind of simulator? What company are we talking about? Which specific product from that company? What's the efficacy of the technology in terms of how effective it is in actually teaching people? And then what's the privacy policies? I mean, this was like ubiquitously my response. It's super long, you know, like I need, it was either no, or I need more information. If I needed more information, that was the list of questions. And, you know, even after that, basically it would largely be a rubber stamping process. There was a couple, and I did a video on it. I've been trying to do some video reports now in addition to my writing. And one of them has to do with a company called Corporate Screening. So one of the colleges wanted to contract with a company called Platinum Educational Group. Platinum Educational Group does these, basically these standardized tests, but the standardized tests use adaptive learning software, and the adaptive learning software by nature data mines, right? You're not just, did you pass or fail, but like, how effectively did you perform in terms of group metrics? How fast did you do it? Okay. And it puts that in a national database. Okay. And so basically if it's in a national database, now, right, the implication is that when I go to take my test certificate to get my job, it's possible that they're not just going to look, this person passed, but they can, if they have a set of clients, right, a set of applicants, well, who do you want to pick? You want to pick the one who not just passed the test, but passed it better than the others based on what's in the national database. And then this company, Platinum Educational Group, also partners with another company that's called Corporate Screening. And Corporate Screening is, it traffics in all things compliance for businesses. So that means, like, you know, anytime you get a job, you know, you go to HR and you just get to do a background check and stuff like that. So they do traditional, like, criminal background checks and things like that. But they also have a Verify Vax. Basically, it's an immunity passport system. It's called it's Verify Students is their student data platform. Then they have an Immunitrax application. All this stuff, they can all be uploaded to your phone, okay? And then they also did like biometric fingerprinting and digital I-9. So they're looking at everything from your criminal background to your tax records to your immigration status, to your student records, to your workforce compliance records, and also even vaccine passports, basically. And then they had a separate platform that's called it's to service what they call self-sovereign identity management. And the graphic for this platform, which is basically it runs on a blockchain, it's basically going to aggregate all those other applications together. The graphic on it is got these people with their phones, and the phones are beaming this light into their face, and their face has a facial recognition algorithm on it. And then next to them is like this dashboard with like bar graphs and pie graphs and line graphs and the little avatar for the person. So it basically is like a little social credit database, right? And this is the company. We're not partnering with that company, but we're partnering with the company that partners with it, which, you know, ultimately suggests that, right, they can have access to all that data. And then once you upload your, you know, your self-sovereign ID, your you know, your think ID 2020, your ubiquitous digital ID, they're just going to put all the stuff I talked about onto one platform. And I pointed this out. I even they gave me the runaround on it. I made a little short video and I sent it to them. And they still rubber stamped it. They still just said, no, we're going to go with it. One of the responses was literally, well, there's no more privacy anymore anyways. So I tried.
Oh man, that's ridiculous. Yeah, it's crazy to see that, you know, they've been basically planning this for so long, and the implementation and all the documentation that you can follow that basically leads you directly where we are today. What about the Gates Foundation Reimagine Education? Could you talk a little bit about that?
That Reimagine term, you know, it really got a lot of attention. I want to say again, March or April, right around the same time that those federal deregulations got rolled out. And so that particular partnership was with Eric Schmidt. I think he's technical advisor at Google now, or at Alphabet, Alphabet being the parent company of Google, but he's still basically high up in the Google Alphabet apparatus. And then also partnered with Governor Cuomo. And, you know, I tried to do some research on that because, it got a lot of media attention and not positive attention. So then you didn't really hear anything else about it. So I wanted to figure out, well, what exactly does this Reimagine project look like? And so I went through the Gates Foundation grants, I want to say several hundred. I mean, it took me a couple of days just going through them and pulling out anything education or technology related or school related. And what I discovered was that there was a connection to a nonprofit called Innovate EDU, which is based in New York. And Innovate EDU also partners with Google's BigQuery. BigQuery is a big database that sort of aggregates all sorts of different types of data together. So basically what you have there is, right, you have Gates and you have Google. So you have Gates and effectively, right, Schmidt's influence in New York. Okay. And what they're setting up was basically a platform that could aggregate all sorts of student data. And I believe, if I remember correctly, that the BigQuery was specifically connected not just to Innovate EDU, but I want to say like Google Classroom or Google Sheets or something like that. You can check me in my article in terms of, it's been a while since I thought about it. But what I later discovered was that at the same time, you have Chainlink connected to BigQuery, okay? And so basically what Chainlink is it's what's called a middleware, okay? And so blockchain can basically only communicate with or transmit information to other blockchain, right? Through like the Ethereum platform and others, right? Well, what Chainlink can do is basically take what they call off-chain data and put it on the blockchain. Okay, so basically all the other types of data that we talked about, like all the learning data, social, emotional learning, cognitive behavioral, workforce, mental health. Okay, if it's not uploaded directly to a ledger, okay, it could be pulled from these other databases and transferred through the chain link. So in other words, what we're talking about is the potential for the data to come from Innovate EDU into BigQuery, and then through the chain link onto the blockchain, in other words, onto your blockchain social credit ID. And then sort of we can, you know, this facilitates the ability to use blockchain for the purpose of social credit data mining. But I should mention that, you know, in the some of the other research I did recently into, you know, the teachers unions, which have, you know, they're just basically right on board with all this technocracy stuff, all this big data, basically social credit stuff. I should mention that that reimagined language has been around since at least 2018, probably goes back a little bit further than that. And so, you know, this language that's largely tied with the fourth industrial revolution, the Great Reset, stuff like reimagined education, reimagined policing, right, has been in the works since before the lockdowns, right? I mean, even the stakeholder capitalism language, you know, the community-based, communitarian partnership language, all of that stuff has been in the mix, you know, along with stuff like ID 2020 for several years prior. And the unions themselves, they even have reimagined education grants as well. I think it's the NEA in particular. Again, you can check that on my website or on the recent articles I wrote on Unlimited Hangout.
Right on. Now, for the last few minutes we have in the show, I want to talk about those three major agendas that you were talking about in the beginning: the Skinner box, social emotional learning, and precision education. We talked a little bit about what they'd be doing with precision education, but tell us more about these other two. What is this Skinner box? What are they trying to do with this?
Yeah. Okay. So the Skinner box again is basically. I can sort of show you a picture of what it looks like. And so let me see. Just to give you a visual illustration here, and if I go to the Smithsonian, let me just go images here. Here we go. I'm going to go ahead and share. Here we go. Oops, I'm on my. Can you see it?
I see. Yeah, there it is. Yeah.
Okay, because sometimes, you know, the window is weird. So this is what it looked like before. Okay, this is like the analog version of it. And you can see like these wheel cards here. This is going to have like multiple choice or matching or something like that. Maybe on here, you might have a short answer that you scribe. And then it's going to basically use the IBM punch card system. You know, that's your early proto computer system. So your multiple choice, depending on which hole you punch out of the card and you feed it through, it's going to read the light. And then it's going to say, you know, if you do it really effectively and you do it really quickly, right, it might go ahead and push you into like, honors or, you know, gifted program or something. But if you're really slow at it, you know, and you don't do very well, it's going to put you into like remediation and things like that. And if you you take that concept and go to Unlimited Hangout, and I just go ahead and I've been writing for Whitney Webb for almost a whole year now, actually. And here's the piece on UNESCO Study 11, Project BEST, and the 40-year plan. It's Reimagine Education. You can check that out there. But if we go to the piece I wrote on the AFT, there's I like this graphic here for what the modern digital version of what I just showed you sort of looks like. And it's called, this particular software is DreamBox. There it is. Okay, so you got DreamBox, Clever, Newton, Brightspace, Leap, Smart Sparrow. These are all various what's called adaptive learning platforms. And again, adaptive learning is, as we mentioned, is, right, they specifically reference deregulating the use of adaptive learning in those The FR18638, okay? And so basically what you see here is you've got the student here. Here's the learning content. Here's the adaptive engine. Here's the intervention engine, okay? Here's the student learning data. Here's the student information systems, the predictive model, and then it feeds out to the dashboard where the student and the administrators are. Okay, so basically it's like this. The student opens up the computer, and then they feed the student a lesson, okay? Based on how the student responds, okay, it's going to pop out the student's learning data, okay? And then as it feeds the learning data into this predictive model, it's going to go ahead and say, oh, this student's smart. Let's give them a harder question. Or it's going to go, no, this student ain't very smart. Let's give them, you know, let's make them do that again. Let's remediate them. Okay. And so then it's going to pump out the next lesson based on, right, the data that comes in here is going to determine the next lesson. Okay. But then notice that the data doesn't just go here in a loop like this. It also is aggregating into this student information system. So that's the student's basically their psychological profile, right? Like every response that you have, every time you get data at this point, it's going to go permanently into this psychological profile. And then all that information is going to be delivered to the teacher and the administrators, who are then going to either modify or perhaps either intervene and give you maybe some extra help on the modules based on how effectively or ineffectively the student responds to the various data.
Man, what could go wrong with AI controlling everything that our kids are learning? I mean, it's already controlling a lot of the stuff that we're seeing on social media, internet, YouTube is controlling algorithms, censorship. So, you know, why not our indoctrination system as well? Man, that's insane. What about the socio-emotional learning? Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so basically the various products that you have are going to be wearables that largely data mine the student's emotions, okay? And so you've got everything from a galvanic skin response monitor to stuff that measures your body temperature or your heart rate or your EEGs, or even they've got facial recognition algorithms that can just base like the face you're making, like, you know, I'm bored, I'm frustrated, I don't care. All right. And all that sort of stuff is going to be aggregated in the same way as, by the way, what I just showed you on the adaptive learning engine. OK, it's just different types of data, but it's going to personalize you using that same sort of feedback loop. Right. Based on just change the thinking algorithms to feeling algorithms, and based on how you're feeling, they're going to tailor the next lesson. What else is different about the social emotional learning stuff is that it's not just looking at, right, feeding back into an academic lesson, right? It can also intervene in terms of like, hey, I think the student needs some kind of a therapy, right? This student needs to see a counselor. This student might need ADHD medicine or, you know, antidepressants, okay? And then I had some other files that Charlotte gave me, and it's a big stack. And one of them is looking at the combination of basically the community oriented policing systems, which is called the COPS program, and like juvenile justice and mental health. Okay. And so you might've heard Kamala Harris say something way back when. She got a lot of heat for this. This is part of the reason why she had to drop out of the race was, you know, she was basically throwing parents in jail if their children weren't showing up to class on time. If your kids were truant, they were putting the parents in jail. So what was the rationale for that? It was because, well, you know, there's statistically students that don't do good in school, or in other words, don't attend school, there's a higher probability that those students will end up in either the juvenile justice system or the adult criminal justice system. So, you know, as a prosecutor, her rationale is that I'm preventing crime because I'm, you know, it's almost like pre-crime, right? Like I'm going to go ahead and put mom in jail now so that the kid doesn't have to go in jail. And so if you look at the student's social emotional learning, That is also can be used to then have mental health interventions, not just for the sake of medical intervention, but, you know, under the guise of we're going to also prevent crime with it as well. And then some of the other algorithms, it's not just how do you feel about the lesson, right? I mean, some of this stuff is very politically charged, right? So Charlotte Isherbeat, you know, focused a lot on what she called values clarification back in the 80s. And so a lot of the lessons were not just reading, writing, arithmetic, right? How good are your language or your numerical skills? It was also like, do you have right think, right? Like, do you think culturally what we want you to think in terms of, I mean, today we can think of it as, you know, the whole spectrum of woke stuff, right? So if you're not woke enough, right, that could also be a social emotional learning a data point that is going to maybe put you in the, hey, we need to counsel this student because, you know, they're radical or, you know, otherwise have wrong think.
Right on. Now, with the precision education aspect, this seems like, you know, the complete kind of in-game integration with our biology and technology and their idea of learning and the metaverse and all of this coming together into this, like you kind of said earlier, like a type of singularity type thing. Do you think this is what they're pushing for? Is this, you know, just complete integration of our biology with technology for their education system?
Yeah, definitely. I would, you know, it's basically transhumanism, right? So precision education, it literally comes straight out of eugenics, okay? And, you know, eugenics had, we mostly think of like Hitler and the Nazis, and so he called it race hygiene, okay? And so it was looking at, it wanted to sterilize you based on your ethnic heritage. But there was also something called mental hygiene, and people would sterilize you. Didn't matter what ethnic heritage you had, if your IQ wasn't high enough, right, that would put you in line for sterilization. And so, you know, if words like moron, imbecile, idiot, those were technically like scientific terms that referred to particular IQ scores, which were categories that put you in line for sterilization, okay? And so if you take mental hygiene and the correlation of IQ with your learning propensity, this is quite literally what they want to do with some of the gene sequencing. When I talked about, they want to see does your genetics suggest you have the intellectual propensity to do X, Y, or Z? They're looking largely at IQ, okay? And so you even had companies like 23andMe, which is tied to Google, by the way, that 23andMe, or it might be Alphabet again, the Google Alphabet apparatus. But so when you send 23andMe your data, there's a little box you can check off, right? You spit in the swab or whatever, and you send it to them. And if you check this box that says, can we use this for other research? Well, they're not just going to send you what your ethnic lineage is, right? Like, you know, are you this much Native American, this much European, this much African, et cetera. They're going to take those sequences. And this is, by the way, important to know. This is how genetics work. They don't look at the DNA and it's like a physical mechanism. They say, this DNA interacts with this other chemical or protein and causes this reaction. It's like everybody who has this sequence of A, T, and C, and G in their DNA tends to have this other expression, whether it be phenotypic or it could be sociological. So if you look at, like, you know, stuff like hair color, eye color, skin, tends to be a pretty high correlation, right? You can pretty much predict it, like Mendel did with his peas and roses and things like that. Okay, but when you start talking like sociological stuff, to the correlations between a DNA sequence and whether someone's an alcoholic or promiscuous or their intellectual level is, you know, higher or lower, it tends to be a lot lower. We're talking like in the 50 percentile range, like best. Okay. So, you know, it's totally correlational, right? There is no, it's not causative. Okay. So, but what they're doing is they're looking at everybody who has a particular sequence, has this level of IQ, all right? And this literally comes out of something called the bell curve by Charles Murray, who's Bilderberg Group. And the guy, one of the guys that he cites in there is Robert Plomin. And Robert Plomin is one of the larger proponents of precision education. He's the guy that says you should have the learning chip, okay? And so at this point, we're just talking about the genes. Now, when you talk about integrating it with the machinery, with the technology, now we're moving to transhumanism. But transhumanism is, just the second iteration of eugenics, right? Julian Huxley coined the term transhumanism in a book called New Bottles for New Wine. Julian Huxley was the president of the British Eugenics Society, so he was himself a eugenicist. And in that book, New Bottles for New Wine, what he's saying is that well, we can still do biological selection. We can still, you know, euthanize and sterilize, and we can still selective breeding. We can improve the human species in that way. He said, however, the way that evolution is really going to be driven at this point is through ideas. So changing the culture. You could also think of the ideas in terms of the types of data that they want to data mine from you and sort of condition and program you with. But then the machines, right, is the modern digital computer. And so once we hook up the brain to the brain computer interface, what you're doing is you're bypassing that stimulus response mechanism, or rather you are integrating it into the biology. So when you talk about the Skinner box, the learning stimuli sort of works, it's associated like Pavlov's dog. So if you associate, you know, the food with the bell, eventually you can ring the bell without the food, and the dog acts like he knows he's going to get food because he associates these stimuli together. Okay. And so you just replace the bell and the food with like a learning stimulus and then a reward. And you know, it could just be a gold star or, you know, some praise from the teacher, maybe a chocolate. Actually, some of B.F. Skinner's machines would dispense chocolate if you got correct answers. All right. And so you take that system, and there's always a space in between, right? The student observes the stimulus, and then has time to think about it before he or she responds, okay? Even the reward, I often felt, sort of belittled by, like, the gold stars and rewards, right? It was like, I know I did well enough. Please don't belittle me and patronize me with these petty stickers and, you know, smiley faces and things like that. So even that, right, there's this space in between. But if you can basically plug the computer directly into the nervous system, there's no space where the student's own consciousness and conscience can actually choose to have a different response to the stimuli other than that which it wants to condition you to, right? And so you're basically talking about the merger. Transhumanist brain computer interface is combining the eugenics and the behavioral psychology. So this, you know, it was always the debate of nature versus nurture. So they just want to synthesize them into a singularity, and they want to just download and upload the data straight into the body.
Man, we're living in like the worst sci-fi movie that I've ever heard of. It's absolutely insane. What do you think are the solutions? I mean, would you recommend homeschooling? I know that there are some parents that I probably wouldn't recommend doing homeschooling. You know, some parents may not have the best education themselves. Maybe not a good idea for them to be teaching somebody anything. I don't know. What do you think the big solution is for some of this stuff?
Yeah, so I think it's multi-pronged. Like, you know, I wrote the book as tried to write a defense of public education because I'm a public educator, you know, and so I still stand by. I mean, I still think we should go to the local school boards and try to actually, you know, talk some sense into the people that are just marching in lockstep with this, you know, fourth industrial revolution and all this big tech data stuff. But I you know, to be totally honest, if I had children, which I don't, they would not be in a public school right now. There's no way that I would allow, especially with the ever looming threat of the mandates, you know, in Illinois, you know, they're here. Right. And I knew it was coming. So I just opted to be virtual, which, you know, I'm feeding the machine, but at least I got my DNA intact. So, you know, I got to take a hit. That's where I'm taking it. So. But, you know, so even if you take your children out of the public schools and you want to homeschool them, which I think is obviously, honestly, the best alternative. I mean, it doesn't mean you're still paying taxes, right? So you still have a right to go to the school board and say, like, I don't approve of this, you know, all this data mining and everything else that's going on. So if you're talking about what to do in terms of homeschooling, you know, you want to be careful not to just sign up for a virtual charter school or another, right? And basically just take the technocracy, take the whole digital apparatus from the school building and just sort of plug it into your homes. Cause then all you're doing is, right, you're basically giving them free infrastructure, so to speak, right? I mean, it's the same system. It's just, in your house. It's all the same data mining algorithms apply. So you want to try to find something that is, you know, analog. Okay. There's all sorts of open source stuff that you can find. You know, I like a guy that, his name's Bruce Gore. He does a classical education. He does a really good lesson for history of philosophy, but it's sort of heavy stuff, but he's teaching eighth graders. All right. But I mean, like he gives you a nice overview of a lot of the stuff that you're not going to get in a public school system anyways. And that is, you know, grammar, logic, rhetoric, the classical method of learning, but also the history of philosophy. He's going to give you some theology. All right. And so that's just one. He's got a YouTube page. All right. And so you can get those lessons for free. And there's all sorts of open source stuff like that. I'm trying to build some of my own. It's really hard to manage, you know, teaching six different classes and interviews. And, you know, I traveled far, both coasts last year, because I wasn't sure if interstate travel was going to exist for much longer. So I visited Charlotte. I visited my publisher. I visited some other people. But I'm gonna be, hopefully sooner than later, creating some of my own open source learning tools that you can use. You know, I'm happy to anybody that, you know, wants to pick my brain or maybe wants some type of you know, consultation or tutoring or something like that. I'd be happy to try to help you with that. And you know, I've got some friends, a few teachers, and basically across the country, who are sort of, you know, we're all on the same page. And what we're trying to do is find families who want to be sort of opt out of this system and therefore want to homeschool. But like you said, might feel like they don't have the expertise to teach a given subject or maybe the whole range of, you know, languages and sciences. And so, you know, maybe start building like homeschool pods by finding teachers like me, myself, and some of these, some of my friends who specialize in different fields. And so, you know, I'm, you know, my discipline is in languages or rhetoric in particular, language arts, but also literature. So, you know, that would be what I would be good at helping with. But my friend Andy Lipson, right, he's a science professional. He's actually got a PhD from Johns Hopkins University, which of all places, right? Yeah. But the point is, right, you know, I mean, we can refer each other to other teachers and other families and sort of build little pods and networks. I think that's sort of the best way to do it. And maybe even, you know, you can, once you get a little pod going or a little network in your local area, then you can maybe start having some in-person stuff. If you're not, you know, all petrified of the potential to get infected, you know, go to the park. You know, you can go to the park and do a little lesson, you know, with the whole family, right? You got the parents and the students and the teachers. And then it can be sort of like the old one room schoolhouse where everybody's actually learning together, including the parents. Right. And so the only thing I want to say about that is, you know, you might, even if you're not, you know, an expert in something and you're sort of feel like you're kind of, you know, I don't want to say groping around in the dark, but, you know, the learning curve is sharp and you're sort of learning with your children, that could be a wonderful experience, right? I mean, it could be good for you just to have the extra knowledge, but, you know, it's going to be a way to bond with the children. And it's also going to also model to the children that learning is something that we do because we want to, right? That has its own, it's enjoyable for its own sake, right? It's not, you know, in the classroom setting, you know, with the waiting for the bells to ring and for the teacher to, you know, sort of push you around or whatever to one subject or another, right? And I think ultimately institutional learning in a lot of ways does sort of you know, dim the desire to want knowledge, right? It sort of frames it as like a chore, and it's something you do for authorities who, and it's on their terms and not what you're genuinely curious in. So this could be, you know, an opportunity to sort of you know, reimagine it in the right way, right? Not in the fourth industrial revolution. So those that's what I would suggest, right? Try to do something homeschool, try to find some teachers who you know, are of like mind, who can sort of support you in that journey.
Right on, man. That was fantastic information. For the audience that want to find out more about you, website, social media, books. I know you said you're writing for Whitney Webb as well. So anything you want to let them know about?
Yeah, so schoolworldorder.info is the website, and you can go there and get a copy of my book from Trying Day. It might be sold out. Last few times I checked, and a few people emailed me and said it's sold out.
That's a good
at
thing,
Trying
man.
Day. Yeah, no, it is actually. It's there was some from what my publisher tells me, there is some work in the way to a Japanese firm wants to publish it. My God, just came running in here. I don't know. if you're
to say hello.
He's telling me hello. It's gonna be, there's a Japanese firm that wants to translate it into kanji. Okay, so yeah, it's doing well, but you can get it on Amazon if for some reason the link on my website doesn't work. And then all the links to all my social media are up there. And so I've been making some videos on BitChute, and I got a YouTube until that thing gets destroyed, canceled, right? I'm surprised I'm still there. But I don't produce that much, so that might be why I tend to write more than I can record. Twitter, Telegram. And, you know, I've got that database that I showed on the screen a few times. If you'd like to be able to support me, you know, if you can, I know that, you know, a lot of people have been losing their jobs that didn't want to get jabbed, and it's supply chains and inflation. So, you know, I mean, if you have it to spare, the more you can, you know, if you can subscribe to that database, it'll help me to be able to do more of this type of research and eventually maybe actually work more on providing learning resources and being sort of a consultant or a tutor for homeschool families that need the help.
Right on, man. Yep, like that was fantastic, and we'll definitely have to talk to you again in the future. And until next time, everyone, have an excellent evening, and we'll be talking again tomorrow.